Today's Teisho will be on Case 22 in the Pien Lu, in the Blue Rock Collection. Case 22 is entitled Seppo's Turtle-Nosed Snake. Engo's Introduction. The great universe is boundless. As for how small it is like an atom. Grasping and releasing, developing and declining, are not in others' hands. They are all in your own. If you want to get rid of encumbrances and cut through entanglements, you must transcend form and sound and remove all trace of the activity of mind. Then you will be in an impregnable position and absolutely independent, like a 1,000-foot cliff. Tell me, who was ever like this? See the following. Main subject. Seppo, speaking to the assembly, said, "There is a turtle-nosed snake on the South Mountain. You should have a good look at it." Choke said, "Today, in this temple, there is obviously one man who has lost his life." Later, a monk related this to Gensha, who said, only Brother Ryo, Choke, can answer like that. As for me, I am different." "How are you different?" asked the monk. Gensha said, "What use is there in making use of the South Mountain?" Umon threw down his staff in front of Seppo and made a gesture as if he were afraid of it. Secho's verse. Mount Seppo was too steep to climb. Only the skilled could try it. Choke and Gensha made nothing of it. How many truly lost their lives? Umon knew how to beat the bushes. The snake, its nature so, was nowhere to be found. The staff, suddenly flung down, opened its mouth right before Seppo. "It strikes like lightning. If you try to look for it, you fail. Now it is hidden on this peak of Nyuho. If you want to see it, look at it directly." For a little while, a number of months really, we have been having some irregular scheduling. And if I'm not mistaken, we've had fewer Saturday sits than our normal schedule. We usually have one every other week. But I must say, when I came and sat this morning, I was reminded about how really wonderful it is to sit this way. There's something quite special about practicing with other people. Last night, I was talking to somebody about her sitting practice, and she said, "You know, I have been meditating for some time in my life, but I realize that when I sit here, my sitting is deeper, my meditation practice is deeper." And I have learned that myself, I've discovered that myself. Over the years, it's important to practice on your own, obviously. I practice on my own. I sit pretty much every day in the morning. But when you come together with other people, there's a kind of collective energy which is really quite precious and quite extraordinary. And this person felt it last night. It's not always possible to come here on a Saturday morning It's not always possible to come here on the weeknights or to our location in Princeton or Blairstown. But when people get together in this way and practice together, there's a kind of energy which is really unique, maybe impossible to duplicate. I was saying last night that in some traditions, people mostly meditate by themselves. In Thailand, for example, very often my impression is that monks and nuns go off and do solitary sitting. And it, also, my impression is that in Tibetan tradition too, at least in classical Tibetan tradition, people practiced by themselves. You would meet with your teacher and then go sit in your room and meditate. This innovation of sitting together has a dramatic impact. There's a collective energy that's really quite precious. And also, Saturday sits, I think, are quite special because they give you the chance to practice for a longer period of time. The first period of meditation is an hour and a half without a break. And when you get up, you're usually stiff and maybe a little sore. You go to the bathroom and you come back and you have another session of meditation, perhaps. And you notice how much clearer and deeper your concentration has become. And that opportunity for extended practice is a beautiful way to start or end the week, however you want to think about Saturday. But I realized that even though I only missed a week, I realized I really missed this. I really love this Saturday sit practice. This koan is really quite important, really very important koan. Seppo, speaking to the assembly, said, "There is a turtle-nosed snake on South Mountain. You should have a good look at it." Now, a turtle-nosed snake is a venomous snake, very dangerous, venomous snake. And the koan is about Seppo saying to the assembly, "There is a turtle-nosed snake on South Mountain. You should have a good look at it." What Seppo doesn't say is, "There's a turtle-nosed snake on South Mountain. Look out, don't go near it." What he says instead is, "You should have a good look at it." And that's really part, a very important part of the koan. I think we all know what a mountain is. You know, I myself like to hike in the mountains. Last summer I went up to the Tetons, which are some of the highest mountains in the United States, and I hiked for 8 days. It was really wonderful. They were so high that I had a hard time sleeping at night. I didn't know this, but at night I just couldn't sleep. I was restless all night long. And when I got back, I read something about the altitude. And when the altitude is so high, you don't get enough oxygen. And your system is registering sort of like alarm. You're not getting enough oxygen. And so you can't sleep soundly. I thought it was interesting. Very high mountains. And the first day of the hike was really difficult. It was straight up. I had about a 45-pound pack. And the hike was difficult but glorious. There's something about going up a mountain which is so extraordinary. It's a little bit like a Saturday sit, you know. You're leaving the flat plain below, right? And you're going up. And as you go up, you see more and more, farther and farther. And you have this feeling of freedom or liberation. You know, mountains are like inherently, for some people, I suppose, a mountain is a mountain. But if you like being on Earth, you know, a mountain is inherently exciting. You know, to go up a mountain is a really wonderful experience because your visibility keeps growing and growing. You know, at one point you can see 10 miles. A little higher up you can see 20 miles. A little higher up you can see 30 miles. And the day we went up this into the Tetons, the mountains were covered with flowers. So it was this beautiful mountain valley filled with flowers, as far as the eye can see. So it was this glorious ascent. And once you get up on the mountain, you can look and you can just see for like 100 miles, especially there. You can see down below to the lakes, and in the lakes there are moose, and you can see the clouds overhead. The mountains are a place, you know, they're a place, but they're also a state of mind, right? To be up like that, it's like above it all, we say, you know. And then to have that opening and that expansiveness. And when you look from the top of a mountain, things that seem so large and important seem so small and insignificant, you know. So a mountain is a physical structure, a physical feature of the world, but it's also like an experience, right? And it's no accident, I think, that in many cultures, mountains are considered sacred. Sacred. If you ever go to Mexico, people would build mountains out of stone for their rituals, the pyramids. And maybe Egypt too. Maybe the Egyptian pyramids are really mountains. People say that the people who built the Hanging Gardens of Babylon originally came from a mountainous region in Turkey. And basically they were trying to recall their homeland by building this large pyramid with hanging gardens. So there's something special about a mountain. You know, actually, the word for temple in Japanese is really mountain. So like Tokuganji is really, it means temple, but it's really Tokugan mountain. And in Indian tradition too, temples often had the suffix giri, G-I-R-I, which means like hill or mountain. And people would try to put, you know, the temples would often be located on a mountain. In fact, establishing a temple is called opening the mountain. So when you build a new temple, there's a ceremony called an opening the mountain temple, opening the mountain ceremony, which really means establishing the temple. So mountains are quite important. You know, we're all going up the mountain. That's what our practice is all about, you know, going up the mountain. And when we're in deep samadhi, and when we're in deep mushin, that kind of openness and expansiveness becomes possible, right? It's quite extraordinary. I've been sitting for, you know, 30-some years, 34 years, something like that. And when I first started doing this, I think I was sort of depressed, and I began to meditate, and I didn't really realize why, but it made me feel better, Sitting down on the cushion, straightening your spine, breathing through the dantian, the hara, watching the breath, and in that state, it's sometimes possible to free ourselves from these mental loops. You know, we're often hemmed in by worry and fear. So you turn this way, and there's this problem. And you turn this way, and there's this problem. And you turn this way, and there's this problem. You're blocked in all directions, you know. This feeling of being blocked, of being hemmed in, you know. And you sit down on the cushion, and you watch the breath, and you enter deep samadhi, and you enter mushin. And there's a kind of spaciousness that opens up around you. Even if you feel trapped, you can suddenly feel better. It's like going up the mountain. And so mountains are really not just a physical place. They're a symbol of what happens to us when we practice Zen, you know. And of course, you know, the top of the mountain is enlightenment, right? It's like Daikensho, or even more than that, it's the complete integration of life experience into enlightened mind. So the top of the mountain is this completely integrated consciousness, you know. And that's what we're all practicing for, perhaps. You know, maybe we're just trying to be released from our suffering, which is a good enough goal. It's a noble goal. But maybe awakening is our goal. And so, you know, when we practice, when we come here to sit in the evening, or we come here to sit on a Saturday, we're ascending the mountain. We don't really have a temple, but this room is our mountain in a certain way. This koan is interesting because it says, you know, Seppo, speaking to the assembly, said, "There is a turtle-nosed snake on the south mountain. You should have a good look at it." And this, I think, is worth considering. When you first start practicing Zen, often the good thing about it is that it releases you from your suffering. You know, maybe your suffering is simply nervous agitation. Maybe your suffering is constant stress. You know, maybe your suffering is a feeling of whatever, failure, fear. And you sit on the cushion and it releases you. Sitting can release you from these things if you do it properly. I mean, if you sit down on the cushion and you obsess, then you're not doing zazen. You know, to practice the way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. This is what the great Dogen said. So basically, when you sit down on the cushion, your mind might be quite full of thoughts, and some of them might be somewhat obsessively repeating themselves. But when you follow the breath and you focus on the breath and you call mu, or you work on your breath alone, at some point your mind should become still and a little bit empty. And you want to return again and again to that still, empty place. That's where the healing occurs. Now, if you sit down on the cushion, sometimes you can be so agitated, it's difficult to get there, right? And so sitting can be a struggle sometimes, because you sit down on the cushion, you're focusing on your breath, and you begin to feel, you begin to get caught up in those loops, those tapes, and you, for some reason, can't get free of them, you know? So maybe a whole meditation period goes by, you get up, you walk around, you have another sit. Sooner or later, you're going to get to this calm, empty place. If you practice with diligence, you know, it's important not to allow yourself to get too caught up in those loops if you can possibly help it. But eventually what will happen is that you will get to this clear, empty place, and if you stay there, you'll sort of go back and forth between the things that are bothering you and that empty place, and the things that are bothering you and that empty place. Eventually, you'll feel much better. You'll feel much, much better. And that's going up the mountain that day. Yeah. And for people who are in a lot of suffering, in other words, most people, this is quite a miraculous liberation. You know, there's some people who are so distressed, they're so distressed and troubled that they really can't sit. They are not really ready for this process because their minds won't let them go even enough to do zazen. For such people, things like yoga or running can be very helpful until they can get a more stable concentration. You're lucky if you can do zazen, you're lucky. And being able to practice Zen is really like a great break in life, a lucky break. Because now you can get to this place where you're liberated, at least temporarily, from your fears, and the things that bother you, yeah, these loops. So that's wonderful. And usually, when we can get into that state, we are happy to be liberated. It's like getting up on the mountain, and finally I have an unobstructed view. Right? But sooner or later, it's important to see that we have mental habits that we keep repeating and that cause us suffering, you know. And being able to see those is part of practice too. You know, it's a more advanced kind of practice. So step one is just getting free from birth and death, you could say. Sitting on the cushion, entering Wuxin, experiencing that release. And when that happens to me, it's just like heaven. It's like I too have troubles. I sit down on the cushion. Something hasn't gone right at work. I'm agitated. And I sit down and I sit for an hour or an hour and a half, and I get off the cushion and I feel wonderful. It's like I've climbed up the mountain. And the next day I might have to do it all over again. But just being able to get free is really wonderful. But at some point in your practice, it's important to see that your snake, we could say, you know, to see your turtle-nosed snake. That we all have, this koan is kind of saying, we all have at least one turtle-nosed snake, right? There's some poisonous snake on our mountain that we have to be aware of. And sometimes it takes a long time to be willing to look for it. See, to look for it. I have a co-worker who's had a very, very difficult couple of years. This person was somebody I worked closely with, and then he began to rise up in the structure of the university. And he was moving very fast up the ranks of administration in the university. And then basically a disaster struck. Because he began to make enemies all the way up the ladder, you know. I hope I'm making some sense. But basically, he has a very, very unfortunate view of himself as always right. He trusts his vision, you know, his vision. And he believes that he sees really farther than other people. And so when people disagree with him, he becomes very threatened and frightened. But he doesn't know that. You know, he doesn't really see that fear. But he becomes very aggressive. And so as he was moving up the ranks, he was offending a lot of people. It's like, if you didn't agree with him, he treated you with aggression or like an enemy. And this person was very good at what he did, but this is how he would respond to people who disagreed with him. And at some point, he offended a very high-up person in the university, like a very high-up person, offended a very high-up person, and that person pretty much said, "You're out of here." And so this person, my friend, suddenly sort of fell from grace and went back down the ladder of the administration. That while that was happening to him, his daughter actually tried to commit suicide and didn't succeed, fortunately. But this all happened within like a year for this person. And I've had the chance to work with this person more recently. And the other day I was talking to somebody who worked for him, and this person said, "Oh yeah, I made a mistake," and he really blew up. He chewed me out. And I thought, that is so interesting. You know, this person has learned nothing from his experiences. So he has a snake, see, that he hasn't found, and it's destroying his life, right? Basically, he's hypercritical of other people and can't hear them and can't question himself. This is all part of his personality structure. He can't doubt himself for reasons that are very complicated, I suppose. But his inability to be sympathetic to others and his reflex of responding aggressively or in an aggressive way to others has really destroyed his life. It almost took his daughter's life. And the interesting thing is that he hasn't really freed himself from this. You know, he's still caught up in this habit, this karmic loop. And I suppose he might never get free. But you know, we can free ourselves from these things. We can begin to see our mental processing. You know, we can begin to see how we play games with ourselves, or how we construct our experiences in negative or destructive ways. You know. This is our snake. We all have a snake. It's hard to see. But usually, you know, the snake is associated with, you know, fear. Fear. You know, we all want to go up the mountain, whatever our mountain is. We all want a glorious ascent, you know. And we all hope to be up there on the top of the mountain looking out with that unobstructed view. You know, it's a beautiful vision of life. It doesn't matter whether what we're talking about is zazen or our careers or intellectual pursuits or art. You know, we all want to be up on the mountain. This is the human way. We all want to have the unobstructed vision. And there's this other part of ourselves that's very frightened of not getting up the mountain. Because down below, it's so constricting. And it's like being blocked in every direction. So, you know, it would be nice to just go up the mountain, but we all have our snake. You know what I mean? We all have our snake. And it's so hard to see. Other people can see it, but we can't see it. See, other people can sometimes see our snake, but it's very difficult to see your own snake. You know, I think you know you're in the presence of your snake when you're filled with when you're coming from a place that's not open, calm. When there's a kind of desperation in the way you act or in the way you think, you sort of know you're in the presence of your snake. You know, I mean, my friend, when he feels threatened, he lashes out. And he doesn't see this behavior. He doesn't see it, even though it's really cost him dearly. And we all have those habits. So part of Zen practice is learning how to be free. But at some point we have to have insight into the sources of our own distress. And that's, you know, insight is part of Zen practice. It's what this koan is all about. So the koan is asking you really, what's your snake? What's your snake? And that can be a big question, right? You know, what's your turtle-nosed snake? Sometimes when I sit down on the cushion, you know, I have to confront my own negativity. And it can take many different forms, you know. Often it's sort of like I mean, different people have different personalities. My friend, when he feels insecure, he lashes out at others. You know, when I feel insecure, I lash out at myself. You know, we all have different ways of, we all have different snakes. And you have to know your snake. But when you're acting from this place which feels desperate or constricted or blocked, when that's where you're acting from, you know you're in the presence of your snake. You know? And you need to sort of understand the sources of your distress or the sources of your responses. My friend, the one who is so aggressive towards others, has an interesting history, which he's written about, by the way. When he was a boy, his father was a novelist, was a professional novelist, and the novelist started his career doing quite well, but as he went on, it became harder and harder for him to get his work in print. And his wife was a professor. He married a professor, and she pretty much paid for everything. And she had a salary, she raised the kids, she paid the dental bills. The writer, the novelist, you know, spent a lot of his time writing these books that couldn't get published. And so my friend grew up in a home where his father began to develop deep depression and eventually tried to commit suicide on several occasions. And my friend, you know, is the product of that situation. So, you know, his father was really like an unsuccessful person. And I'm sure as a little boy, my friend wished that he could help his father be successful. Or I'm sure he was, his father's failure caused my friend a lot of distress. And so, you know, I think when my friend is trying to do something, he is afraid he's going to be a failure like his dad. You know, he's terrified of being like his dad. And so, you know, there's a desperate quality to his response to challenges and obstacles. He lashes out viciously, even if it's trivial. And it's coming from a place of fear, or it's coming from a place of deep insecurity. Yeah. And when we're acting from that place, we know we're in the presence of our snake. Yeah, and we all have a snake. So, you know, you can't ignore, this koan is really saying, you don't have to deal with your snake today, but sooner or later you have to deal with your snake. You have to. And, you know, I've often said, you know, one time somebody came in here and tried Zazen, and he said, this is wonderful. Wonderful. He said, I sat down in the cushion, I felt wonderful. And then 2 weeks later I said, how is it? And he said, well, it's not wonderful anymore. You know, he had gotten that relief, but somehow the snake appeared, right? And you don't have to deal with your snake right away. You know, so basically, you know, it's very good to just come in, sit down on the cushion, enter Mushin, and experience release. But sooner or later in life, we have to deal with our snakes. And you don't have to deal with them today. You know, you'll be ready to deal with your snake when the time comes. But it's to get to the top of the mountain, you have to deal with the snake. And we all have one, you know. And so you know, if you find that there are certain things in life that cause you distress, that feeling of being trapped or of being claustrophobia or desperation. When you're in that state, you know you're in. That's the snake. And basically, all fully enlightened people have passed through the snake. You could say, you have to pass through the snake You can't ignore the snake. You have to work through the snake. You have to find your snake and pass through the snake. And this is difficult. This is the work of many years. But it's doable, you know, and it's quite wonderful because, you know, sometimes I will come in and sit down on the cushion and I have my own snakes, yeah. I can be quite trapped deep in my snake. And the thing is, I kind of know my snake. You know, I remember, I know my snake. It's like, ah, yes, I know you. Yeah. I've seen you before. Right. And you know, sitting is working through the snake. So you might start out on the cushion in a place that's quite desperate, you know, quite claustrophobic, quite trapped. And you can recognize, there it is, you know, there's my snake. My friend's snake, which he hasn't really looked at, is, you know, coming in. My friend actually found his father on the ground, unconscious, having tried to kill himself. So that's a snake, right? That's always haunting him. In fact, my friend told me once that he has a hard time. He was telling me that the strangest thing had happened to him. He was driving his family across the Chesapeake Bay Bridge to Chincoteague. If any of you have ever taken that drive, it's a huge bridge. It rises up into the air. It seems to just go up into the air, and you can't really see the ground. It's like this bridge. You're driving on this many lane, like a 10-lane highway, but it's up. You just seem to be up in the air. It's as though the bridge is going up into the clouds, and then it descends. It's a giant bridge. And my friend said he was driving up the bridge, and he began to shake so uncontrollably he had to pull over, and his wife had to drive. See, so that's a snake, right? There's a big snake there. Something unresolved, and it's still unresolved. Right? Sometimes we can feel that we'll never get out of the snake, you know. But I'm always amazed, you know. The other day I was talking to somebody who had been really distressed, really in a lot of distress. And all of a sudden, this person had just come out of it. Yeah. And a number of factors did it. You know, a number of things did it. But it was like a different person. You know, one minute, really distressed, trapped, blocked, unhappy. You know, we're all there sometime, right? And then all of a sudden, this person was, laughing, open, having a wonderful time. Just having, you know, I was like, oh, this person's laughter was like music, right? And it was like that person had worked through the snake, at least for a while, and eventually for good, right? And it was so wonderful. The koan says something interesting. The great universe is boundless. Up on the mountaintop, it's boundless. As for how small it is like an atom. Grasping and releasing, developing and declining are not in others' hands. They are all in your own. Now that's very interesting, isn't it? If I'm reading this correctly, what the koan is saying is this, is that, you know, basically we can feel boxed in by our circumstances. But really, it's how we deal with our circumstances. It's not the circumstances. This is what Buddhism is. This is like Buddhism 101. You know, certain situations cause us to encounter our snake. Or certain people cause us to encounter our snake. You know, And when we're in our snake, it's hell. There's no visibility. You know, being in the snake is so unpleasant, being trapped in the snake, you know. So different from being up on the mountain. But the koan is saying basically that we have control over that situation. Or another way to put it is, it's not the situation, it's our response to the situation. And so the resources for solving the problem are in ourselves. And I think Zazen is all about encountering these obstacles in ourselves and gaining insight into their sources and working them through. And I think this is what had happened to my friend. You know, trapped, and then open, laughing, having a wonderful time. And that person had passed through the snake, you know. And maybe we have to pass through the snake 100 times, maybe 1,000 times. But eventually I think it's possible to become very open person, very, you know, to live on the mountain. How does it put it in the koan? It says, you must transcend form and sound and remove all trace of the activity of mind. Then you will be in an impregnable position and absolutely independent, like a 1,000-fathom cliff. Tell me, who was ever like this? See the following. Now, in just a little while, we're going to have a presentation. We're going to end our morning, our wonderful morning of Zazen. And some people will have to leave, but if you want to stay, there's going to be a little presentation on the board, what the board is doing. You know, a year ago at this time, we had a much larger event where we were talking about, you know, the future of our community. And we had some wonderful ideas about how that future could unfold and so on. And this is about a year later, so now there's a board and it's going to make a presentation. Now, during this whole period, it was quite interesting because, you know, everybody who was here a year ago at this event announcing the formal structure, the creation of a formal structure for our Sangha, everybody who was there was very, I think, excited by the prospect, very interested. And we all wanted to see the mountain, you know, the mountain. Maybe all of us had an image in our mind of maybe a temple, Zen center, so on and so on. And, you know, what has happened in the last year is quite interesting to me. Because some people who were here last time aren't here today. It's very interesting. You know, some people have actually quit our group because of internal tensions about how the future is going to unfold. I thought that was very interesting because this happens in so many groups, you know, where people come to practice, and they practice with great purity and success. And then there's a moment in the life of a community where people start encountering, it's like snakes everywhere, you know? Snakes everywhere. That's interesting, isn't it? It's like all of a sudden there's a snake everywhere. And I think it has to do with the dynamics of Zen groups, actually, you know. People come to this with great hopes and many dreams and aspirations, and also many unacknowledged fears and much unacknowledged desperation. And so you would think, what's so hard about having a formal structure for our Zen group? We've existed for 16 years. What's the problem? But all kinds of tensions and all kinds of stresses, many tears, you know, have followed from that in the last year. And I don't think anybody is at fault. What I think is happening is that we have all had to encounter our snakes. You know, in Chinese tradition, when you create a new temple, you have to go through a ceremony called opening the mountain. And it involves placating all the spirits of the mountain. And you have to actually put to rest the wild spirits of the mountain. Interesting, don't you think? And in Tibetan Buddhism also, you know, in many stories about people who founded temples, they have to deal with, they have to do battle with demons. Isn't that interesting? There's stories about like Padmasambhava, and he has struggles with demons as he's establishing a temple. And sometimes you'll see statues of, Tanka, big Tanka with Padmasambhava, and he's subduing demons. And you think, what is that all about? That's old time thinking, you know, demons. But what's really happening is that when something like this is about to take place, when people are creating a community, suddenly all the snakes come out, you know? And it becomes difficult for people to see their snakes, you know? This is part of the process, though. Sometimes people are able to see their snakes and work them through. And sometimes communities are able to see their snakes and work them through. And sometimes not. You know, all we can do is do our best. And sooner or later, if we just persist, we will be free. You know, we will be free. The most important thing we can do, in my opinion, is not create a Zen center or a temple or anything of the kind, although that would be quite nice. It's just to keep practicing, confronting our snakes and working them through. And the koan basically says if we do that, you know, it's going to be a really nice life. Senpo, speaking to the assembly, said, "There is a turtlenose snake on the south mountain. You should have a good look at it." Choke said, "Today in this temple there is obviously a man who has lost his life." In other words, he seems to be saying somebody was killed by the snake. See, dangerous, danger. Later, a monk related this to Gensha, who said, "Only Choke can answer like that. As for me, I am different." "How are you different?" asked the monk. Gensha said, "You know, who cares about South Mountain? You know, the problem isn't the snake. The problem is you want to be on top of the mountain. See? Just be here now." Uman threw his staff down in front of Senpo and made a gesture as if his staff were a snake. So basically what the koan is saying is that these are people who have worked through their snake. They're people who have worked through their snake. So they're not acting from a place of desperation or fear or insecurity. They're acting from this place they're acting from mushin, from the spaciousness and generosity of somebody who has nothing to gain and nothing to lose. Right? We're not often like that, right? Not often like that, but when we are, that's quite wonderful. Yeah. Mount Senpo was too steep to climb. Only the skilled could try it. Choke and Gensha made nothing of it. How many truly lost their lives? Uman knew how to beat the bushes. The snake, its nature so, was nowhere to be found. The staff, suddenly flung down, opened its mouth right before Senpo. It strikes like lightning. If you try to look for it, you fail. Now, it is hidden on the peak of Nyoho. If you want to see it, look at it directly.